So hello and welcome to the Leadership Centre series of podcasts. The Leadership Centre is a charity whose mission is to build leadership capacity across the public sector to enable positive and lasting change for citizens and society. In this series, we'll be exploring the various dimensions, challenges, opportunities and dilemmas inherent in the activity and practice of leadership in organisations and across our places. In this podcast, we invite John Atkinson and Myron Rogers to explore the key aspects of leadership through the practice and dilemmas that leaders face. Their fascinating conversation explores issues such as trust, identity, judgment, and delve into Myron's maxims to provide examples of how to use these as a leader. Enough from me. Let's hear from John and Myron.
Hello, I'm John Atkinson. Today I'm in conversation with Myron Rogers about leadership. What is it to understand yourself as a leader? What are some of the things you might do? What are some of the signs that you might pick up on? What are some of the models that you might use as you try to engage with problems that may at first seem straightforward, but can get really quite complex and difficult as you get into them?
I'm Myron Rogers. I'm a consultant. I do really large-scale change for the most part, working in organizations of all types across the world. I've been at this work for about 35 or more years, depending on how much hair I have left on my head. I've known John Atkinson for about 15 years, and I'm really grateful to be in this conversation with him and with you, and hope that there are some tools, models, ways of thinking that will be useful for you and your as you face your really demanding work lives and leadership challenges.
So the question of what is leadership and what do we do as individuals around leadership, there's a much made of the difference between leadership and management, and you know, lots of people have their definitions of it. But if you Google what is leadership, you end up with hundreds of thousands of different answers, and some of them are just circular. Leadership is what leaders do. So I wanted us to get into a more specific space. I wanted us to get into a place where we could talk about what are the things that we need to pay attention to? What's going on? How do we know? And I'd like to start us into it by a statement that was made that says, well, use your best judgment at all times. So, Myron, how would you know you were using your best judgment? What sort of things would a leader be doing that would help them sort of anchor their activity in something that they could trust?
That's a great question, John. I'd actually start with probably everything we experience in life, the world, and our communities as unintended consequences, as things that we don't want to see arose from really people using their best judgment. And that best judgment being limited by what our experience is, what our you know, the ways in which we were raised, the dynamics of our organization, what happens day to day that says this is good, that's bad. And ultimately, that mixes up into a way in which I see the world, and I make judgment on the way in which I see the world. But that way of seeing tends to be rather limited. It tends to be something that is curtailed by the role I'm playing in my organization. You know, if you're in a council and you have a particular role, then you live within the bounds of that without paying attention to what else is going on outside that is connected to it, that plays against it. I think there is a role for leaders in helping the organization know itself and to know itself really, what it is, not based on what it says about itself, not the mission and vision and value statement, but what it's actually doing and what I'm actually doing as an individual. And how do we, you know, as leaders, how do people open the space to be in conversation across hierarchies, across professions, across locations, as equals, to look at this decision we've made, the action that we've taken, and its consequences, and to build a kind of shared picture of reality, I would say, that says this response actually looks like what we intended, or this response doesn't look like we intended. You can take that even farther. I mean, as skilled leaders, I know, go very deeply. They go into what's the source of whatever those consequences were, and how do you find the source of that? You know, what's the source of fear? What's the source of trust? What's the source of liberated action, you know, where I can act and people have confidence that my action is going to be congruent or coherent with where the whole needs to go?
So that's saying to me that as leaders, we're creating space for conversations that are there probably going on anyway. They take place by the coffee machine. They take place as we stand in the lift at the end of the day. But we're consciously making a space for people to try and make sense of what's happening in the world around them, as opposed to taking up the space that people have by almost corralling activity into certain frameworks, into certain specific activities that don't allow room for people to use their judgment.
Yeah, no, absolutely with you. I mean, what it brings to mind instantly is the kind of compulsion we have in our society around metrics, around targets, around narrowing a particular role and a particular set of skills where, you know, the whole person and their ability and their experience and their wisdom actually is not allowed to come in, but that, you know, the achievement of a particular target, narrowly defined, and the assumption that if everyone achieves their target, then the system will be operating well, is actually fundamentally false. It's the interaction of all those different activities that are producing the outcomes that we're looking at.
So if we've got a system that's as you describe, it's got people in management roles running a system of targets, performance, metrics, data, activity, how do we change that? What's the activity that starts to change people into a space where they're more comfortable with using judgment? Because historically in organizations, using judgment can be a risky thing. In the military, I think they used to say that was a command decision. That was a euphemism slightly for you were very brave and now we're going to correct you. So how do we get out of this belief, if it is societal, in just divide it into the separate bits, just measure those bits accurately, just recruit people against job specifications that deliver that, and into a space where people can really exercise judgment in a way that makes something fundamentally better emerge? Let's think a little bit then about culture and where it comes from and a leader's role in that. Because culture seems to me remarkably resilient. People talk about we're going to change the culture. We talk about we're going to have leadership programs that do that, or we're going to be more specific about our values or whatever. And yet culture seems to perpetuate. It seems to almost take everything that we do and reinvent that back into the way that we've traditionally done things. So culture seems particularly sticky, for want of a better word. And I wondered what thoughts you had about how leaders might do something that would start to get at that stickiness.
Well, the first is just to affirm that issue of it being sticky. I mean, any culture, you know, it's such a catch-all term, but in fact, it is the web of relationships and the web of meaning-making that exists anywhere that's grown up over years. And it's not just something that happens in a particular organization. It happens in an organization that's connected to an environment. It happens as we go through school as kids. We learn certain behaviors. We carry those. They get distorted. So once that culture arises, what we know is that it persists through time and space. Most of the ways we have of trying to change it is to, well, people are used to this. We could fire people, or we could retrain them, or we could restructure the organization. But fundamentally, our experience is that doesn't really change culture. That as you said, you know, that we drag all those new things in and distort them into the old of what we had. Because there's, you know, a lot at play there. Our identity is wrapped up in that culture. What it is we're valued for, what we value, is all wrapped up in that existing culture. As we change that, there's resistance right away at the level of the individual or at small groups or at the system as a whole. But the other issue about how do you invite in the change, it's the locus of change is a different place, right? It's not the structure of the organization. Though structure matters, there are some structures that are more facilitating than others. It's really about the quality and nature of relationships, how the different parts of any organization, any system, any community, the quality of how they relate to each other, and how we actually know whether, you know, what our system is. Do I know the system that I reside in and how it connects to itself? You know, one of the good things that leaders can do is that persistent action of helping the organization know itself, but also in facilitating or urging, really, making available connections to individuals, to parts of the system. When you see someone doing something Are you aware that something else is going on somewhere in the organization or in the community that these people should be in relationship to? Can you facilitate that relationship? It's beginning to connect up the organization, the system, the community in a different way so that it has more access to the intelligence, wisdom, experience that resides everywhere in it.
So that all makes sense. I mean, to me, it seems that once you connect people in that way, we make altogether better decisions because we've got better data. We can reflect better on what we're intending to do. Yet if the culture itself is resistant to that, if the culture very much keeps people within strict organizational silos, for want of a better word, it's an act of quite some vulnerability for a leader at any level to step outside of that and say, well, hey, I'm not going to play. I'm going to play differently. And almost always we tend to find that intriguing, I guess, at first, and then we tend to squash it because we say, well, they're a bit weird. They don't do things our way. And so it feels to me that if you're going to lead in this way, in this space, part of it is being comfortable in your own vulnerability and recognizing that as you do that, as you make yourself a bit of a target, as you make yourself more open to others, you're actually making yourself stronger more than at risk, that people connect with that. And you invite people to bring that part of them that they've not been using much, that they've not been able to fully deploy into their work because they see you doing it. There's a big part of leadership that to me says, if I'm going to expect you to be vulnerable in change, if I'm going to expect you to be uncertain, then I need to go through that too, and I need to experience that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. It's interesting, the vulnerability issue, and also the issue of the inherent unknowability of, you know, the consequence of what we're doing, that we can't know it really specifically. We may be able to substitute prediction for reliability, in which we know that the system is reliably going to produce the results we want. But the specifics of it, we don't know, and that puts people at risk. It makes them vulnerable.
But that throws up that if we can't know where we're going, one of the things that leaders are always expected to do is have a vision, have a plan, paint a picture. And it feels to me that, you know, one of the art forms to me of really great leaders is they're able to hold a sense of direction, we're going in one direction and not another. But they're almost working one step at a time. They're sort of building towards that direction, and they're able to work with new stuff as it merges.
Yes.
And that's quite hard when people have been taught and have come to expect and conditioned almost to believe that the leader has to have a plan. We'll go through it step by step by step. If we deliver the plan, we'll get to where we're going. When, you know, we've seen with political events recently all around the world that things can be rocked fundamentally by something that occurs almost overnight, and that the best made plans become worthless.
Yeah.
So for me, there's something about how do we as leaders hold this sense of direction in what we're doing, yet allow a vagueness and a space not only to respond to what goes on, but to allow other people in, give other people space to be themselves and to bring what they can bring.
Yeah, the whole issue of different voices. I guess here's a switch, actually, is that if you thought about leading an organization, that everything that goes on is co-created, that the idea of we are only co-producing or co-creating when we make a decision to instigate that activity. In fact, everything we do, everything I do as a leader, goes into this system and people engage with it and they recreate it into something that is actually the life of the organization. I was... this is a story you've heard before, John. Years ago, when I was just a baby consultant, I guess, I had a client. It was the largest chemical manufacturing plant in the world, the DuPont plant in West Virginia in the United States. And they had it was a very dangerous, toxic environment, and they had a lot of safety problems. And they were being threatened about being shut down. And instead, the leadership team went into a multi-day dialogue, sitting together for pretty much for a week, the top 12 people in the organization. And the exploration was, what's the source of safety? And in a very rule-bound organization, you would think that they'd say, well, we need to know the policies and procedures and the structures, and we need to practice this and test everybody and measure their effectiveness. And this team actually came to the conclusion that that wasn't it, that their people actually knew this stuff, that something else was going on. And their answer to the question of what's the source of safety was caring. This in a very macho culture, you know, a bunch of engineers in the West Virginia foothills. And as a team, they said, if we're going to get you know, movement on this safety thing. They developed a set of principles that they decided they would live by and they judged themselves by. And they announced them to the plant by saying, here are our principles. We're going to live by these. Will you help us understand what they mean? Will you engage us and tell us when we're doing this right or doing it wrong? So they opened up the conversation. And instead of imposing a set of values or principles or behaviors on the rest of the people, they held them themselves. As you said, you know, it's that modeling of that behavior and modeling of a different kind of behavior that encouraged ownership in the plant by getting engaged with what you see. You know, do you see this behavior as being, you know, I said I'd be open about all information. Do you see the behavior that I've just engaged in as being open in that way or not? So, by the way, there's a happy ending to the story, which is that this plant became the safest manufacturing facility in the world for 5 years running.
So there's something in that story for me about meeting people where they really are mm-hmm. and not where we'd want them to be. We could easily have started in that story by saying, well, these are our values. You all will accept those too. I mean, I always feel that my values have been formed over the 50 plus years that I've been in this world. And if somebody tells me that they ought to be something different, I'm going to have a reaction to that. It could be positive, could be negative. But there's something about how do you meet people as they show up? And rather than be disappointed that they're not what you thought they might be or exuberant because they come with aligned with what you're thinking, how are they engaging with what you're doing? What is it that makes them come to us in that way? How do we understand where they are if we're going to be able to engage with them on a level? And it feels for me in leadership, there's always been a lot of time just invested in understanding people, talking to people, connecting to people, relating to people with no specific purpose almost other than those are good things to be doing. And from that, you build a relationship that enables you to have a much more direct and important conversation at the moments that you need to. And people know that when you have to make hard decisions, they know that you understand them and make them, knowing the impact that they might have on them.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is in some ways the development of trust. I mean, people talk about safety in organizations. I think, you know, in terms of emotionally safe places, personally, I think it's overvalued. I think that there's something about our need to take risks with each other if we're going to advance our relationship in some way. And sometimes you don't know what the outcome of that will be. But, you know, from the leadership perspective, meeting people where they are, you have to have created an environment in which people are willing to open up and to share with you. That DuPont story, the chemical manufacturing story I shared, I mean, the invitation to people to challenge their leaders' behavior was authentic and real, and it took a while for that to rest with the organization where people knew that that was really what was going on.
So meeting people where they are, to me, means not you immediately have that great conversation. Meeting people where they are could be 2, 3, 4 years earlier than that when people are antagonistic and or they will tell you that they don't trust you. Or they won't tell you, but that's the conversation that's taking place offline.
Yeah, and trust. We open up that wonderful thing about trust. About trust is an emergent quality. It comes from a variety of directions. It comes from the quality of relationship that we're in with each other. It comes from sets of behavior that we watch over time, and we make sense out of, you know, what do we trust? What do we not trust? What is trustworthiness? As a leader, understanding that consistency of behavior over a long period of time that is inviting, opening. It's, you know, it's kind of the hosting quality of a leader that creates the space for difficult conversations and doesn't just create the space for them to happen accidentally, but insists really on them really holding the space firmly for people to walk in and you know, have the conversation that they need to have.
And for me, there's something in that about making your thinking explicit. People will attribute whatever you say or whatever you do to whatever is in their background, you know, whatever lens they look at you through. And there's something about being explicit for me as a leader about why you're doing the things you're doing, what you're thinking, where you don't know what to do, being clear about that. You may know where you want to get to, but that doesn't mean you know how to react to the situation in front of you. And that if you're able to open up that space in that way, then people do tend to step into it or sufficient people do. And with that, for me, there's an element of trust comes through because we're in different relationship. I'm being clear about what I know and what I don't know. And I'm inviting you to do this with me.
I think that's right. I mean, the word that comes to mind now is curiosity. I mean, is there enough authentic curiosity among everybody in the organization, but especially among leaders, about what's going on with you? You know, I mean, one of the examples I'd give is that, so say we say, trust your judgment, act on your judgment. You know, you're free to do the right thing. There's a lot of phrases like that that come up in organizations. The dilemma is that the history of the organization, the culture, your particular place in it, you're seeing something you've never seen before, right? Like the environment doesn't stay still. Our rules and regulations might, but our way, what needs to be responded to is different all the time and unique. And it, you know, it shows up suddenly. And I take action in response to that thing. And you as my leader look at me and say, that's not the right action. That's not the action I would take. And, you know, somehow or other there's punishment involved in that. There's some form of you know, sometimes they make a new rule and regulation to make sure no one makes that mistake again, which seldom ever works. Another response to it would be that is seeing that you took that action because of the way you see the world. And until I understand how you see the world, I can't actually judge whether that was good or bad. And additionally, until you understand how I see the world. So we're moving into a conversation which is kind of co-creating a picture of reality so that I can begin to trust that you see the world the way I do, and therefore you can take action that I can trust is the right action without me, you know, giving you an order.
So in some respect, in the old days, we'd have labeled some of that under team building. But it's really, it's a bigger question about who are we? Who are we when we come together? What are we for? Why do we do it? Why do we do it this way? And how do we,
and
make
how do we know?
And how do we, yeah, and how do we make decisions about this stuff? And that, I think, is always there, but rarely explored. And I think one of the things that I've seen really good leaders do over time is at whatever level they're operating, it's sort of build or help the group build a sort of tone, a sort of tonal quality to how they do stuff that says, well, this is how we would do something. That's not the way we'd do it because that feels wrong or because that's not something we signed up to or whatever. And that there's therefore quite an exploration constantly, I think, in leadership around the who are we question, which seems sort of obvious. But so many organizations, it just gets lost, particularly as we get to scale. Small businesses do this sometimes a lot easier. You know, owner manage small businesses. It's almost the personality of the owner you can see as you walk in a door.
Right, and they're very close to purpose, yeah, original purpose.
Exactly. But when you get to something that's, you know, it's got a century of tradition, it's got 3,000, 5,000, 8,000 employees, the who are we becomes a much harder question, and it gets broken up into different bits.
Yeah. Again, though, I think it's not an easy thing, but it is about an ongoing conversation. I'm always reluctant to use this example, but I'll use it anyway. I mean, I did some work on learning during battle with the U.S. Army after one of the Gulf Wars, which one. They had developed a culture in which they recognized that learning was the most essential piece of it, and learning about who they really were, how they saw the world, and the action that they were taking against it. So what they built was a practice of flat dialogic conversations with some very, very simple questions. One was essentially, what did we intend to do? The next one was, what actually happened? Forget what our intent is. What actually happened? And lay it all out.
Well, it's the old quote, no plan survives contact with the enemy.
Yeah, exactly.
You can intend this, and when you get there, all sorts of stuff kicks off.
Right. And therefore, there's, you know, they had a rule that, or a belief that information had no hierarchy and that everyone engaged in a particular form of action or judgment or decision, regardless of rank, all had equal information and all of their information was wrong because it was incomplete. Right. The information they held was OK, but it was just incomplete. And that the first thing was to build a picture of who are we really? What did we actually do? And in order to do that, you have to, you know, mediate all these power dynamics, rank, privilege, hierarchy, professional, you know, grades of so that people can sit together and speak as equals. And, you know, just as an aside, the Army got very serious about this behavior because they wanted to liberate their front line 18-year-olds in a tank to make a decision in the moment of battle without an order, and they wanted that decision to be congruent with where the whole needed to go. That's a form of, you know, kind of judgment and liberation that can only come through time and practice of who are we really, you know, that getting a sense of who we really are.
I think that's an important for any organization. We often use military examples in leadership, and often people will have an adverse reaction to them. But in this case, the front line doesn't matter whether it's a military front line, it's a social worker, it's a manufacturing worker, it's whoever. We want people to be able to use their best judgment at all times in order to do the right thing. And to do that, they need to understand a sense of context. And the context is not just what's going on, but it's who we are. What is expected of me in these sorts of circumstances comes out of my sense of what this organization is all about and what really matters here. And that only comes by us talking about it together. And if we don't talk about it formally, people will talk about it informally and make their own judgment of it. So it feels to me always that leadership that doesn't take up that space, it doesn't move into the area of those sorts of conversations and just leaves them to take place while we run our performance frameworks or we design our capital programs or whatever it is we're doing,
yeah,
is abdicating a space to people to just make whatever sense of it they will. And we have no influence on that. And so it's really important for me that as leaders, we're in that conversation about, well, that's not how I think we work, and having the courage to say that.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things going on here. One is, you know, how do you bring the, as I would call it, how do you bring the hallway conversation or the coffee conversation into the center? I mean, because that's the conversation that really matters. You know, you're in a meeting and you walk out of that meeting and what do you say to your friend? That's the information that actually needs to be in the room, because that's the one that's telling you where.
Well, we've all been in them, Myron, haven't we?
Yeah.
Where we walk out and the conversation as we go out and we can say, well, that'll never work.
Right.
And nobody said it
exactly.
as we do it. And we need to hear that in the space. So, Myron, I mean, we've worked with many leaders in many sorts of organisations over, well, a quarter of a century in my case and rather longer in yours.
Hey, wait, stop that.
But there are some things that seem to hold true whatever sort of organisation we're in. There's some things that we've found that just, if you pay attention to them, really make a difference. You know, they've now got your name on it,
right,
as a set of
right.
maxims. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about Myron's maxims.
Yes, Myron's maxims. You know, I have to say that they weren't named by me. They were named by clients that way. So I can absolve my ego, which is quite big at the moment, since we're talking about maxims. A couple of things about them I would say is that, you know, underneath the conversation we're having, John, as you know, is years of systems theory and the application of systems theory to organizations. And, you know, all that sounds really complex. And I've spent my career trying to figure out how do these things make sense in the real life of an organization, the real life of a supervisor in a county, the real life of a line worker somewhere, the real life of a chief exec. So over the years, these have evolved. So I'm just going to run through them quickly and see if they stick for the listeners in this. The first one is people own what they help create. Full stop. If you don't involve people in the creative process of anything that you're beginning, taking up, anything that's going out to the public in some way, anything that's happening within the confines of the organization or a profession, if you don't invite people into that creative act, they take whatever you've given them and they recreate it based on their current culture, their current way of seeing the world, their current identity, the nature of relationships they have. They screen information through this. People own what they help create. That's number one.
Number
two. Number two is real change happens in real work. Now, immediately people get into a conversation about what's real, and that's a useful conversation because it helps people sort through what's important, what isn't important. But that change is, what it signals is change is located, it's embodied. It's not actually what I say, it is what I do. It's the kinds of actions I take when I'm on the front line of my organization, carrying out my job, my role, whatever it is. So real change happens in real work is number two. Number three is those who do the work do the change. It essentially means I can't change you. You have to do this yourself. And you actually go and execute this change and the sense that you make of it in your organization, which points back to the kinds of conversations we need about, is this action we're taking the right action? Does it look like the intent that we're putting out there? There's another maxim, it's connect the system to more of itself. In biology, you make any system healthier by connecting it to more of itself. In social systems, it's really quite the same. You know, most of us take action that we don't know the consequences of it as it ripples through the system. We don't know that, you know, something we did in this meeting at a particular time had this effect on those people on the front line somewhere. So connecting the system to more of itself so that we see the way that we're interrelated, we see the impact we have on each other. The next one is start anywhere, follow it everywhere. There's always an argument about where to start any change program. Do you start at the top or the bottom? The middle, in my view, first you start it from everywhere. And the other issue is that you just pick something that's significant, that people can agree on matters. It has energy and passion around it, has a lot of information and experience around it. So as people engage around this starting anywhere, the first thing that happens is it'll provoke the system to present itself. It'll provoke people to say what matters, what doesn't. This is the wrong thing to do. This is the right thing to do. We pay strict attention to what's coming up. John, you're fond of quoting Kurt Lewin in this, who says, you know, if you ever want to understand a system, try and change it. And that's what's up in this question. And then the final one is a little poetic. It's the process you use to get to the future is the future you get. So the process you use to get to the future is the future you get. If collaboration is the rule, you want to move into a collaborative culture, you can't do it through hierarchical command and control. You have to move into processes that are themselves collaborative. And that means in some ways going back to the first maxim, people own what they help create. People create that process together.
Maureen, we've been using the word systems in this conversation as if it was an understood thing. And it means lots of different things to lots of different people, potentially. When you use the word system, what do you mean? What are you talking about?
Well, that's a lovely question, John, because, you know, system language is everywhere and few of us understand it, including me, occasionally. So first, the hard answer is there's only one system, and that's everything. It is basically this notion that everything is connected to itself. In the organization or work or place context, for me, what a system, the system is defined by the work that we're trying to do. So if you look at any particular problem that we're trying to solve together, we look at everyone who is connected to that particular problem. And all of those people are in a connected relationship of certain qualities, holding certain information, all of which needs to bring to bear on the issue that we're trying to solve. So, you know, a system is really just, there are multiple systems, they sit inside each other, and what defines them is the work we're trying to do, and therefore, where's the information, the people, the relationships that we need to do that work.
There's one thing I'd like to take from the maxims, Myron, and flip back, which is, and you've said it on a number of occasions, which is, whenever we're doing something and it's really not working, how many of the maxims are we in contravention of? And when I look back over my work at the times where we've been trying to lead some change through and we're not getting anywhere, when you ask that question and look back, you know, real change happens in real work. Did we just get suckered into a change team that was disconnected from the day-to-day of the organisation? People who do the work do the change. Did we engage with the people who are face to face with the public, with customers, with processes that we're running? You know, if we're missing these things out, then almost invariably it's going wrong. So I always think it's quite fun to do the flip and just go, well, if it's not working, how many of these have I managed to contravene?
No,
and usually many more than one.
You can use them that way, and you use them the other way as design criteria, right? So you have them in both directions. If you use them as design criteria, you should be in this question, you know, the process you use to get to the future is the future you get. So all of those criteria should challenge the way we normally design this.
So I always think, Myron, when I hear things like this, when I go to conferences, if you go to a workshop, you know, the stuff you agree with, the stuff you disagree with, the stuff that provokes, there's new lines, new things you want to explore and all the rest of it. But in the end, it turns on, do I take something and just try it? And if I take something and just try it, then most likely I'm going to carry on doing that. So my encouragement to people listening to this would be to say, some of this will have washed over you, but something's stuck. If it's stuck, take it and give it a go. And, you know, I just wondered if you, between us, we might pick out one or two things that are good avenues into exploring our own capacity as leaders and how we might do things.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of things you could pick out to try. And, you know, it is start anywhere, follow it everywhere, see what happens.
So maybe that's something, Myron. Just start. Just,
right.
Just do something.
If you're in the midst of or starting a new project of some sort, you could pull together a design team that actually represents the system that you're trying to work with, even if that's citizens, go outside the boundaries, and use the maxims as design criteria for the project that you're doing. That itself is would be learningful for you. It would open up new ground as a leader, but it would also do the same for the people on the design team.
There's one for me, which I think, you know, is not dissimilar and links to that, is if you're in a messy environment, if there's something you're trying to get through which is hard, what voice are you not hearing? Who could you go and talk to who would hold a very different point of view to you? So it could be within the organisation, go to someone from finance if you're frontline, or if you're in finance, go to someone from the frontline. Find somebody you wouldn't otherwise speak to. It could be somebody from the community. It could be somebody from a government agency. It doesn't matter who it is, but just go with an open mind and go, well, help me. What's going on here?
Yeah, I like that. I would think, you know, there's something also about values. You know, how do values become real? I have a fair amount of skepticism about values exercises because they so often put a lot of energy in the front end into naming what the values are, but the true definition is in action. So how would you, as a leader, invite people in to defining what the indicators of any values might be, how they actually show up on the streets of the organization or the streets of those you serve? And how do you know that, you know, if you have a value that's honesty, how do you know that this behavior is actually honest? And getting people to move in that direction of a constant conversation of how does the work they're doing match up with the values they're espousing.
I think that really matters, because if we go back to where we came into this, which was around, you know, use your best judgment at all times, what guides our best judgment is how we live our values. And if we understand what it means to act, say, with integrity and respect, and we've explored that, when a new situation, you know, appears in front of us, or when we're in a difficult situation, we act almost instinctively because of the conversations we've had about that, because we understand what that thing means. And that's when it becomes really, really valuable. I remember working with a client, Johnson & Johnson, who have a credo, a whole list of values on the wall. And I said, does this actually count for anything? And the answer they gave was, yes, more here than anywhere. We have a conference every year where the senior vice presidents sit at the front table and anybody in the organization can attend. You cannot be blocked from coming, and you can raise any question you ask, like, why are we selling stock that's not CE marked, so it's not considered safe to be sold in Europe, in India, if we hold all lives to be valuable? And, you know, the vice presidents have to answer that. And it's because we have this interrogation of what we do that's important. So I would say that's a great one. Let's interrogate our values and determine what they really mean for us. So, Myron, that's been a really great conversation. Thank you for your time today. I hope that the people who listen to this will be able to take something and just try something, anything. Take it and do it, but learn from it and see where it takes you.
Well, thanks, John. It's been great being in conversation with you. I really think about the people that this is for, that you're in service to, that you're trying to help along, and I hope there's something useful here. This is an unfinished conversation. The conversation about leadership and change is never ending. And if any of us actually knew the answer, we wouldn't be having this podcast.
Well, thank you very much to John and Myron for sharing their experience and insight. Keep an ear out for the next podcast in the series.